Accession number 32297, reel 16.
John Dixon, reel 16.
Yes, good morning, Richard. Just before we carry on from where we left off last time, could I just retract very quickly on to time at Crail, because something happened there which was very sad. We had, the squadron had its first fatality. One of our petty officer pilots who had obviously found himself a girlfriend who lived on a farm just not far from Crail airfield. He was trying to impress her with showing how low he could fly over the farm, and he completely misjudged the fact that the farm had got a hill in the middle of it, and he crashed into the hill, killed himself, crashed the aeroplane, and also killed his air gunner who was flying with him. I was just 19 at the time, as you may remember, so I was particularly upset. Cedric Coxon, our CO, was absolutely livid, because the lad had broken all the rules. He was showing off, and he'd written off one of the aeroplanes, and he killed himself and his air gunner, and that was that. They're buried side by side in Crail churchyard, and whenever I go up there I usually manage to just to pop in. So that was what happened at Crail, and that was the first time we had a fatality in the squadron. Others followed, but we might come to that later.
So you'd flown down?
We flew down to Burscough, and we met our observers there, and I think I told you I'd met Bambi. Did I mention Bambi? Well, it's obviously why he was called Bambi, because he looked like the young form in Disney's cartoon film. And he certainly looked far too young to have left his mum. He obviously looked at me and thought I looked probably just as young. And we were formed as a crew with Jeff Squire, our air gunner. And I'm very proud to say that Bambi and I remained good friends for 61 years until he died, sadly, in 2006. So we kept in touch.
What did you do when you got down there?
Well, it was a bit of a flog. I mean, basically, the training changed to more put the emphasis on the observer's side. Navigation exercises, wireless training exercises. You know, we had to get used to flying with observers, and they told us what to do when we were over the sea, that sort of thing. We continued with our torpedo training, and we did another thing there which quite frightens me when I think about it. We flew close formation at night, and you imagine this in blacked out Britain, and Cedric Coxon, our CO, was of course a past master at night flying, and he could see no reason why we couldn't all fly in formation at night, which we did. And I've got vague memories of flying in and out of quite a lot of cloud near Blackpool Tower, you know, terrified that I was going to lose sight of the plane that I was formating on. And how we did it and survived, I don't know, but we did fly close formation at night.
You've described obviously flying in formation and how you did that in daytime, but what do you use at night? What kind of visual reference system?
Well, very, very small. The leading aircraft, usually the CO, takes off, and when he's airborne, he has a downward recognition light, a white light. In today's world, that would flash. In those days, it didn't. It was a steady white light, and you had to just try and make up your mind whether it was a star you were looking at or the aeroplane. And you homed in on that light, and then every aircraft had on its wingtips blue formation lights. They were on the trailing edge of the wingtips and on the tail, and that's what that was your point of reference. Whoever you were formating on, you kept your wings relative to his blue lights. Obviously, you couldn't have vast numbers of aircraft in pretty formations like the Red Arrows or anything like that. You more or less went almost in line astern, not quite in line astern, but just sufficient so that you could follow one another round. And then, of course, the idea was that you carried out night torpedo attacks, not the same as in daytime. You didn't come screaming down. You tended to go in more on the level, shall we say, but you still had to illuminate the target and fly an attack like that. But it was something that I did find quite nerve-wracking, but we all came through it.
Flying over the sea at night as well, is there any problems that you can sort of encounter there?
Well, not no more than in the daytime, really. I mean, you had to watch your altimeter very, very carefully, and I don't think we probably reckoned to fly less than about 100 feet at night. I may be wrong, but as an individual, you might have flown less than 100 feet, but certainly if you were in a gaggle of other aircraft, you wouldn't want to be much lower than that. But certainly that's what we did then. And the other thing was, I mentioned that we were basically doing observer type training, and a word you've probably come across before, and we'll have a thing called a NAVEX, which is a navigation exercise, which was like flying a cross country exercise from point to point. Only a NAVEX is done over the sea with no reference to any land whatsoever. The observers were told what courses to steer for how long, and then to calculate the wind effect on them, and they worked out the courses. And then the idea was that they were given the final course was to bring them back to landfall. And of course the test of a good exercise was how close you actually came back to the point where the observer was aiming. And one of my earliest recollections on this one was obviously Bambi was trying desperately hard to impress me as to how good a navigator he was, and he was. I mean, I'm being a bit facetious, but he was an excellent navigator. But we'd flown out on this navigation exercise probably for about 2 hours, and we were on the way back, and we were going to make landfall at St Anne's Head, just south of Blackpool. And he was calling out landfall in 2 minutes, landfall in 1 minute, and he in the back of course couldn't see ahead. I was in the front. The visibility had closed right down. We were flying in really mucky weather, and there was no sign of any land at all, and I detected that his voice was getting a little bit anxious from the back. Can you see the land? Can you see the land? No, I can't see any land. We should be able to see the land. And we went on and on. And I thought, well, he's made some dreadful error. And instead of flying into the land, we were flying back out to sea or something. But we kept on. And I suddenly noticed that what was the sea, or supposed to be the sea over which we were flying, was showing a rather dirty brown, muddy colour. So it didn't look quite like the open sea. And all that had happened, and if you look at a map, you'll understand, St Anne's Head to the north of the River Ribble estuary, which is quite wide. We were about a mile or maybe 2 miles south of where we should have been. That's all, quite a small error. But we were flying straight up the estuary. And of course we could see no land reference at all, so I tumbled to it what had happened, picked up Preston, flew up as far as Preston, and we were quite low, and I knew from Preston if I turned southwest and followed the railway line I would be back at Burscombe. It was just shows you how small errors, and it was only a tiny error, could lead to all sorts of panic.
There's also the element there of you having to trust your observer, isn't
there? Oh, absolutely. Yes, when you go, I'll tell you another story a bit later about that. But you just have to. And it, I mean, it's the whole crew. One trusts the other to do whatever job they had. Well, fortunately, it worked very well for us. But
is there a sense of responsibility as the pilot of the aircraft as well for the other two crew members, that you're in charge of that machine?
Well, you're raising a very moot point, Richard. There was a time that the captain of the aircraft was always the observer. This dates back to the old Royal Navy days before the war, I think, that the observer was the senior officer, and a pilot could really be just the taxi driver, really. But this all changed, of course, as time went by, and as the pilot became responsible for the attack side of anything, really it was the captain who had to be in control. In any case, the obvious thing, if something went wrong, the aircraft was in trouble, and either you had to ditch or bail out or something, it could only be the pilot that made that decision. So yes, as far as I was concerned, it was always the pilot that was the captain of the aircraft.
And was it a sort of interesting situation to be in when you knew that it was your crew rather than when you'd flown occasionally with other observers or air gunners? The idea that this was people that you were looking at?
Well, yes, we did, and I think as a squadron, I mean, we were pretty lucky. We did reasonably stick very closely to our own crew. Occasionally you did fly with somebody else. I won't say that any of them were less competent, but it was just a sort of slight difference of personality. The one thing that you find is if you're on a long, boring navigation out over the sea, navigation exercise, you're out over the sea, what do you do? I mean, I personally would not have a lot of chatter. Now, Bambi, my observer, talked even more than I'm talking to you now. He was a real chatterer. But he had to be told that, you know, you concentrate on your job. So he and Jeff, the gunner, used to sort of think I was being a bit dogmatic, I think. So what did they do? They used to sing opera to me. And so I had to put up with this until I got to the point and I said to them, if you don't shut up, I'm going to pull the plug out and then you're on your own. Which I think I did once or twice. But we were just a happy, happy crowd, and I think we all knew that when it was time to shut up, you shut up.
And I take it there's growing skills as well. You were feeling more confident in the skills that you were all getting as a crew.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it was pretty obvious. And I'm just going to come on to two more points while we're at Bursko. As I say, we just continued practicing what we'd learnt at Crail and doing all the navigation, etc., etc. There was one thing as a pilot, and I think it probably goes for quite a few of us. If ever there was an opportunity to fly another type of aircraft, we used to take it. Not everybody, but I used to always be looking round to see was there another aeroplane I could fly. Now, Cedric Cox and my CO and the others, they didn't actually encourage you to do this, but they did not discourage you. Because anything to improve your piloting skills was considered a good thing. While we were there at Bursko, there was the station flight, which were basically they just did communications between various airfields, and they had this aeroplane called a Stinson Reliant, which was a high-wing monoplane, cabin monoplane. I can only describe it like a taxi. With a door at the side and all very civilised, and it was used for communications and occasionally for training wireless operators and that sort of thing. And they had one of these at Bursko, so I persuaded one of the station pilots chaps to show me all the controls. In fact, he did take me up, that's right, and I had a trip with him. It was dual control, let me say, side by side, so I quickly learned how to fly this little thing. It was a very pleasant little aeroplane. Had four seats, actually, but there we are. I landed it, and I took Bambi, my observer, up, and of course he was insistent that he wanted to learn to fly. So, having got him in the air, I let him take over, and he had his first flying lessons, and he did reasonably well. If I now fast forward until he was 68 or 69 years old, if you can believe this, he took his private pilot's license. And soon after that, he invited me to go as his crew for a trip when we flew around Norfolk. But no, he was anxious to learn. So, and we just did the on trip to Inskip or somewhere like that. And so that was one thing we did. That was a bit of fun. By this time, and I hope I'm not belabouring the time we spent at Bursko, by this time it was pretty obvious to us that we had completed pretty well every exercises that we could do, and we were virtually a fully worked up squadron, and we should have been very nearly ready to go to sea. And I my memory might be letting me down here, Richard, but I think at this time we were told that we were going to be part of the air group on one of the new aircraft carriers of the light fleet class, Colossus class as it became known. There were four carriers in this class, and they should have been ready, or at least one or two of them should have been ready for service by November, which would have coincided with when we were ready. But things were going wrong at the dockyards and various things, and in fact Vengeance, which became our carrier, was not commissioned into the Navy until the middle of December 1944. So we were, obviously we were wasting time up to a point. But there was one item missing from our training, and I expect you've probably guessed. We had never landed on an aircraft carrier, and we had to obviously learn to do this. I've explained before that the normal drill was that pilots went as individuals to the various schools. They went to East Haven for the deck landing training school, and they qualified as individuals. We were working up as a squadron, so we had to learn this as a squadron. And our senior pilot was a chap called Peter Poole, a lovely little Cockney lad, and he called us all together one day while we were at Bursko, and it was in October, I suppose. And he said, right, lads, and he said, we've now got to learn to land on a ship. So he said, we'll make a start on it now. And he said, we'll start tonight. And we looked in absolute horror, you know, that we were actually going to do our first dummy deck landings at night. Now, dummy deck landings, and any naval pilot will talk to you and will say, it's always called ADDLS, A-double-D-L-S, ADDLS. Aerodrome dummy deck landings. And this basically meant you flew round the aerodrome in a simulated a carrier circuit. You did all the drills except put the hook down, the arrestor hook. You didn't put that down, but you flew round at about 300 feet on the circuit. You did all the turns at exactly the right place, and you were holding the aircraft just three or four knots above the stall on the engine. So you were flying pretty close to the limits. And it's not something that, you know, it's not a comfortable way of flying, because if you're flying at 300 feet and you did inadvertently stall the aeroplane by going a bit too slow or winding up the turn a bit too fast or something, you didn't have enough height to bail out or do very much. So it was slightly a nerve-wracking way of, until you got used to it, it's not a comfortable way of flying. And of course the normal drill was you would practice this. You'd go off on a session of idles. You'd probably do 7 of these circuits in about 20 minutes, and you were controlled onto the runway by the batsman. The batsman being the deck landing control officer, who stood near the landing point with these big yellow bats, like ping pong bats, and he signalled to the incoming aircraft by moving his bats either up, down, sideways or whatever, to make you follow his instructions. And it was mandatory in our Navy that you did follow his instructions. I think in the United States Navy they were guides, and the pilot, you know, just took notice of what the batsman was doing, but in the end he took control. But in our Navy you did exactly what the batsman told you to do. Going back to us, I mean, we'd never done this in the daylight, but they just said, oh well, we're going to do it tonight. And so, to our absolute horror, or to my absolute horror, we started doing idles at night. And the very first one I did could have been a disaster, because I've said you fly around the circuit and you come in and you follow the batsman. At night, the batsman, his bats are illuminated. He's got illuminated bats, and he's got a light in the middle of his chest so that you can judge how his bats are moving in relation to whether he wants you up or down. Anyway, you come round, you follow him, and when he gives you the cut signal, all you then do is chop the throttle off, hold the control column steady, and the plane should bang down quite nicely on 3 points. And then if you're doing idles, all you then do is pick up the flaps, the landing flaps, open the throttle and just go straight off. You don't stop, you just take off and do it again and again and again until the session is finished. So I'm doing my very first idle, and I'm quite anxious and a bit nervous, as you can imagine. So I bang down on the runway quite satisfactorily and panicked, you know. I thought, well, I've got to open up the throttle to get airborne again. And I picked up the flaps, and the lever, the flap control lever, which brings the flaps from landing through takeoff to normal, there's a little gate on it at that point, a little gate in the lever, like on an ordinary car gear. And I slipped the lever through this gate, in the dark, of course, and had pulled the flap lever right up, which, what did that do? It put the dive brakes on. Now, my Barracuda will not take off with the dive brakes on. In fact, I don't think any aeroplane would take off with the dive brakes on. So there am I, hurtling down the runway, wondering why I'm not getting into the air. And it's dark. Anyway, I realised something was amiss, and chopped the throttle off, hoping that I would stop before the end of the runway. Well, I nearly stopped before the end of the runway. I didn't quite. I overran the runway and ended up in a hedge. And sort of climbed out and thought, well, what's gone wrong here? And of course I saw what had happened, that I'd put the dive brakes on. I felt all kinds of an idiot, but it was just being over anxious. Luckily, no one was hurt. Well, it was only me in the aeroplane. I wasn't hurt. The aeroplane was barely scratched. In fact, I don't think it was even scratched. And they just pushed it back, and off we went and did it again. But anyway, that was a lesson learned.
Strange that you were learning in, at night for the
well,
first
it is
time.
Extraordinary. I don't think any, if I talk to friends now who went through similar, you know, flu, barracudas and that sort of thing, they would find this extremely difficult to believe. And yet my logbook proves it, that we did first aerodrome dummy deck landings. Our first deck landings were done at night. and we continued this for you know, a few days, and then we did them in the daylight as well. I think it was all really to instill in us the confidence that we were perhaps a cut above. I don't know, maybe I'm being a bit boastful, but we certainly were able to cope with these things that were just thrown at us quite normally.
So it was assumed that you could maybe start.
Yes, you can do it. Do it. That's it. And Cedric Coxon was quite pleased for us to be able to show that we could do these sort of things. So there we were.
Can you tell me about the batsman's signals? What he would do for you?
Well, the thing is, as you turn round onto your final approach, by that time you've got your wheels down, you've got your flaps into the landing position, and if you're coming onto the ship, of course, you've lowered your arrestor hook. So you've set everything up in the cockpit. You've got the propeller in fine pitch, and everything is set up, and you're flying, as I say, for perhaps 4 knots above stalling speed. I can't exactly remember what these figures were, but probably 60, 70 knots, something like that. As you turn on to the final approach, the batsman will have finished with the aircraft who is immediately ahead of you, and he turns his attention to you. So you can pick him up from that position, and he's facing you as you come round. And what you're hoping to see is that his bats are horizontal, straight out from his body, which means you're in exactly the right situation. If he thinks you're too low and he wants you to go up, he raises the bats above his head, and that means you just increase a bit of power to lift the aircraft up. You don't pull the stick back, you just increase power to get it up. Opposite, if you're too high, he will put the bats down round his knees, and that means you ease off a bit of power. If he wants you to one side, he will tip you by turning, you know, diagonally. If you're going too fast, he will put one bat behind his back, so there's only one bat showing, and that will show that you're coming in a bit too fast. If you happen to be going too slow, provided you're not swimming by then, he will wind the bats round to make you come on. And then if he doesn't like the approach at all, if it's your fault, or if it's the fault that the deck is not clear, or if he doesn't want you to land, he will wave you off by waving his bats above his head, as if he's waving goodbye to you, and you then open up and go round and do another circuit. But if you're in the groove, as we say, he bring you over to just at the point where he wants you to cut the throttle, and that will depend on whether the deck is going up or down. And he gives you the cut signal, which is by chopping his bats across him down below his knees, and it's a very distinct thing, and you just chop the throttle off, and hopefully you just sink onto the deck, and the hook will engage the arrestor wire, and it will jerk you forward in your straps, and you're down.